The Campbell Group has teamed up with PI Perspectives to offer listeners top-notch, affordable insurance solutions. Private investigators can get insurance for their business for as low as $305 per year. Apply now at PIPerspectivesInsurance.com and receive a quote back within 24 hours. Do you enjoy our podcast and the guests we bring you? Since 2019, Matt and his team have done their very best to give you amazing shows each week. If you feel like our show has helped you to be a better investigator, or maybe even inspired you to become an investigator, please let us know. We're looking for testimonials. Drop Matt an email with a recorded 20 to 30 seconds of you talking about this podcast. You can also email him something verbal about the website. His email is matthews@satellitepi.com. And if you really feel blessed for having this content, consider supporting Matt and our show by joining Investigator's Toolbox. You really have to see version 2.0. And at just 49 cents a day, it's a no-brainer. Come join the National Association of Legal Investigators in Boston on April 4th and 5th. This Region 1 seminar will feature speakers that focus in on criminal investigations, including the Boston Marathon bombing. Earn up to 6 CE credits and brush up on your skills. Learn more at NALI.com. That's NALI.com. Over the past year, our industry has been the target of foreign governments and agencies that have attempted to recruit unsuspecting investigators to gather intelligence or immediate expatriates. PI Perspectives is teaming up with the Federal Bureau of Investigations to get the word out about this ongoing crisis. If you've been contacted by an individual or company that might seem suspicious, please contact the FBI at tips.fbi.gov. You can also contact the New York field office at 212-384-1000 to report suspicious activity in any state. The link is also in the show notes. Even if you completed a job and it still doesn't sit right with you, you can report this activity. The only way to stop this trend is to work together. So let's do it. Welcome to this week's episode of PI Perspectives. Hey, are you listening or watching this program on YouTube? Go ahead and hit follow if you are. We're just a few follows over the 1,000 follower landmark. Help Matt and his team pass this important goal. Now, back to the program. On today's show, we welcome back Dan Collins. During his last visit, the guys started to discuss post-conviction investigations, and today, they give a more in-depth view of how to get started in this line of investigative work. So take notes and get ready to mark a plan. The guys also discuss the upcoming NALI conference on April 4th and 5th in Boston. So please welcome Dan Collins and your host, private investigator, Matt Spare.
And welcome to this week's episode of PI Perspectives. This is Matt Spare, your host. Today, I'm very happy to welcome back Dan Collins from Level Investigations out of Massachusetts. Dan is also the Region 1 Director for NALI, the National Association of Legal Investigators. There's a conference that's taking place in April, April 4th and April 5th, right outside Boston. And we're going to talk about that today, and we're going to talk a little bit about post-conviction investigations. Dan has been a guest before, and we started to chat a little bit about that, but we're going to dig in a little deeper today. And I want to welcome Dan, a newly minted CLI, certified legal investigator.
Yeah.
Dan Collins, welcome back to the program, and congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Matt. Good to see you again, as always. Love seeing you and all the things that you do for NALI and for the industry in general. I know you're so busy, but you still find a way to support us all, so I appreciate it. Sure. But yeah, so the CLI, I tested last year, and I finally got around to it because it's such a big commitment to do, but it's absolutely 100% worth it. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah. Congratulations. I think there are, 67, 68 CLIs that are active right now?
Something like that. I don't know what the actual number is. There's more than that in total if you count, because we've been doing the CLI, NALI has for decades now. So we've got a number that are retired and that have passed away. But as far as, CLIs that are still active, it's somewhere around 60 or 70.
Okay. All right. Well, that's good. Good to know, man. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the conference. This is something that's been on your heart for, a couple of years. I think we started talking about this, and you said, I'm going to throw this thing together. I'm going to do it together. We had talked about maybe doing something in New York, looking to do something for the East Coast. And kudos to you for putting together such a great program. Tell me a little bit about what those that are attending, what they can expect.
Yeah, we're really excited. I'm really excited. I'm involved with the Northeastern University co-op program. Northeastern University is a big school in Boston, and their co-op program is like an internship. It's part of the requirement for graduating, and so I take on co-ops as a part of my business, and I'll train them, and they get to help me on cases, get themselves get their hands dirty on real actual criminal and civil investigations. And so I posed that to Northeastern University, and they agreed to partner with me on this conference, which I thought was fantastic. Right. So we're hosting actually right in the middle of Boston, right across basically from the Prudential Center on Northeastern campus. It's in the east, the Egan Research Center building, which is a very nice building right off the T. And we've got a full day lineup on April 5th, which that'll include crime scene stuff with Watertown police detective Dave McNeil, is a friend of mine. He was the crime scene guy at the Boston Marathon bombing, for example. Mm-hmm. And so he's going to be using that as kind of a case study on what you need to do and not do on a crime scene. You know, we've got an attorney from the Secretary of State's office doing a whole big thing on public records requests and how you can formulate those, what kind of records you can get, what do you do if they're not responding in the way you want them to. We've got Steve Verano, who is an LPDAM and NALI member, talking about mobile device forensics. We've got Bruni Marrero coming in from New York City. She's with the Legal Aid Society, and she'll be talking about criminal defense interviews. Frank Corso is an excellent civil litigator, and he'll be talking about working with investigators, specifically post-conviction, a little bit too, because he's also had a lot of success from the civil side in getting wrongfully convicted parties some sort of award settlement for having been in jail for so long. But the evening prior, also on April 4th, is going to be great because we've got a whole post-conviction panel. We've got two attorneys involved in the CPCS Innocence Program. We've got two investigators. One of them works for that CPCS program, and the other one being myself. And then we've actually invited two exonerees to join the panel. So that'll be interesting to get kind of the very personal cool view. Somebody who was wrongfully convicted, both of these guys served more than 20 years in jail each. Wow. And they're very involved now, and I'm looking forward to them joining the panel as well. So that'll be April 4th. Come on out if you haven't registered yet. It's going to be a great conference.
Yeah, just packed full of content. And that's one of the things that I really love about NALI. It's so easy to get behind what NALI does and what they bring to the table. And if you're an investigator that's out there, like, and you do legal investigations, like, you should be a part of this association. It increases your network, your ability to have coverage in different areas. But more importantly, it gives you access to the best investigators in the industry. It's such a community where people just help one another, and you're able to bounce ideas off of each other. And there's real value to that, right? Learning those skill sets or different ways to do things is just picking the brain of other investigators. It's probably one of my favorite organizations to be a part of, to be honest with you. I really see value in it.
Well, NALI's glad to have you at all of our events and be a part of NALI, of course. We, my first NALI conference was probably 10 years or so ago. And I remember just being blown away. It was wild to me talking to all the investigators that I was sitting around and the experience that they had. And I said, you know, this is like, this is my people. I felt like I was finally at home with that sort of organization, with legal investigators and people who focus on, you know, really bettering themselves as investigators, really bettering the industry as a whole with legal investigations and how we can make the justice system better through the civil and criminal stuff that we do. So NALI's been great. And I was really excited to become a little more involved with it the last few years as regional director.
Yeah, you're doing a great job. And you know, just that friendship, the camaraderie that you have with your peers, and knowing that if someone's a member of NALI, like they've been vetted, you know, you have to go through a process. It isn't just to submit an application, pay a fee and you're in. There's a background actually that gets done. And then, you know, taking a step further to get that CLI certification, like that's a big deal. I mean, it's not easy to get that done. There's a lot of reading material that's involved. There's interviews. You gotta write a paper. I mean, it's they make it hard on purpose. And you know, it's definitely something that if you testify in court, it's good to have. If you sell for your business, it's good to have just the prestige behind it. You know, they don't make it easy on purpose though.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I can I'll vouch for the vetting process because as regional director, I'm the guy that does the vetting for every single applicant that comes through in my region. I really put in a lot of work to make sure that they're NALI material. You know, fortunately, most of the people that apply are excellent investigators and there's no issue. The CLI exam is a little bit different too, because there's no class to take to earn your CLI. It's basically a test on experience. You need to have years of experience to even be qualified to take the test in the first place. But, you know, there's, like you said, there's a lot of books that you're going to want to read up on just to make sure that you cover things. There's an ethics panel, there's practical exams, you got to write a white paper. It's a tough process, but it's so worth it to being able to call myself a CLI up on the stand, like you said. Yeah, definitely. And we're actually, I didn't mention it before, but we're doing a small presentation on the CLI exam at my conference and about writing your white paper and being a good writer in reports and demonstrative evidence, that sort of thing too in your cases.
Yeah, no, it's all interesting stuff. So if somebody was on the fence about going to this thing and they're trying to decide, like, what's the value? What am I getting out of this? Like, what is the most important thing you want an attendee to walk away from this event with?
There's no way that you can show up at an event like this and not learn something. You're going to be, there's a lot of discussion. I love that my conferences, when I put them on, we get the crowd involved in the question and answer, the back and forth, the discussion. And it's not just like a lecture from a podium at the front of the room. You know, we're all professionals together in the room together. And so we're having that discussion. And aside from the learning, we're offering continuing education credits for attending, of course, but the networking, you know, being able to meet somebody from, you know, five or six states away. You know, I often have cases that will have a witness that's since moved to Minnesota or Florida or Canada or whatever. And I've now met somebody from Canada or Minnesota or Florida, and I can say, oh, hey, I know that guy. I've already met him. I trust him. I know he's been vetted as a NALI member. I'm going to call him, and I know that my case will be taken care of.
Yeah, not only that, the message boards that are out there too. Like, even if you haven't met somebody, you can throw it out there and know that whoever's responding has been vetted, and, like, you know, there's a good chance they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So there's just that benefit to it. I mean, it really is priceless. It allows you to service your clients better. And at the end of the day, you know, accomplish the task that you're looking to accomplish. You know, one of the things I really enjoyed about the NALI Winter Conference down in Tampa was what you had talked about, that kind of round table, that after the fact, let's all sit down and brainstorm about an issue, some of the problems that we've been having about this particular topic. How do you solve this, right? So I was able to participate in some of those. And man, it was great. It was small groups, maybe about 15, 20 people per group, and say, okay, we're going to talk about this issue. You know, how do you get around this issue? When, you know, what are you seeing in the state that you're at where this is going on? Go, you know, talk about it. And, you know, just that back and forth of being able to pull from people that are in it and doing it. There was such incredible value to that. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed that a lot.
Even just the other day, one of those kind of organically popped up through the listserv, the mm-hmm. NALI listserv. Somebody was asking about a particular kind of case. I don't remember exactly what it was. And then, you know, you get this person popping up on the listserv saying, I know something, or I would love to learn mm-hmm. more. And suddenly there's a Zoom call happening just a few hours later.
Yeah.
And there was, I don't know how many people attended because my schedule didn't allow for it. But just the fact that there's that community of yeah. Absolute professionals that are willing to participate and be involved and help you be better. It's fantastic.
Absolutely. I think one of them I sat in with, Troy Fleming, was talking about like products liability and, yeah. you know, evidence gathering and witness interviewing with regards to that. Like what's the approach on that? And what are some of the pitfalls or some of the issues that you're having in gathering intelligence? And it was just so helpful. And knowing that, okay, I don't have that issue now, but you know, let's say 6 months from now, something pops up and I remember, okay, you know, Troy was, you know, like, he was a good guy that had a lot of info on it. Let me reach out to him and you know, get my 2 cents on that. Right? So shout out to Troy.
there you go.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Thanks, Troy. That was Troy's idea to do those.
Yeah, it's a great idea. you know, us plaintiff investigators, we're cream above the crop there. We know what we're doing. So, you know, the real reason that you're on here today is to talk about the post conviction investigations, and you had written an article for one of the NALI newsletters that I thought was great. I think it was it your white paper for
It was my white paper.
Your white paper, right? Yeah. So, I want to talk about the ins and outs of that because I there are definitely some nuggets in there that if you're looking to do that type of work, this is a good framework. On how to do it. If you're doing it already and you need kind of a brush up, a refresher, I think there's some good ideas in there. But this is my teaser because we're going to take a break here. So everybody sit tight.
Cliffhanger.
When we come back, we're going to talk about post-conviction investigations. So hang tight, guys. We'll be right back.
After 4 years of development, Scope Now is proud to announce the release of Grid. Grid combines OSINT with real-time physical data to achieve new levels of intelligence gathering. Grid supports over 50 data types and hundreds of thousands of sources. Upgrade your OSINT capabilities with Grid and elevate your intelligence team today at scopenow.com. Check out the PI Institute of Education at piinstitute.com. Since 1989, Kelly Riddle has been teaching on subjects such as surveillance, nursing home investigations, insurance fraud, domestic investigations, hidden assets, and accident scene investigations. The PI Institute of Education is a featured learning partner in the InvestigatorsToolbox.com. So check out the free content on the site, then visit the Institute for more great savings on additional classes. Specializing in the research of liability for personal injury claims, Pacific Liability Research offers insurance assessments of all applicable liability coverages to help determine what a case is potentially worth. Have a case with no insurance policy? Since 2019, the highly trained staff on their insurance discovery team has located over 100 million plus in previously unknown insurance coverage. They offer a full refund for any inaccurate results, and they do not charge for no-hit searches. Additionally, Investigators Toolbox members automatically receive 50% off their first case. Just mention Investigators Toolbox when you fill out your first order. More information can be found at PacificLiability.com. Contact them today and discover the immediate impact that Pacific Liability Research can provide.
And welcome back to PI Perspectives. This is Matt Sperry, your host. Today we are here with Dan Collins from Level Investigations out of Massachusetts. Dan is the Region 1 Director for NALI, And today we're talking about post-conviction investigation. So, Dan, I want to welcome you back to the program.
Thanks very much.
Okay, so before we took a break, I talked about an article that you had written that was in the latest NALI newsletter, but it was actually your white paper for your COI certification. So for those that are not familiar with a post-conviction investigation, why don't you break it down for me exactly what that is and why we need it?
Well, I mean, it is what it sounds. It's post-conviction. Somebody's gone through the trial process. They've been convicted, whether by a jury trial, bench trial, or some sort of plea agreement. For whatever reason, the defendant has asked for their case to be screened by an appellate attorney, and that appellate attorney has come up with some issues that may show or suggest that their trial was unfair.
Yeah, and so that's a good point. I'm going to jump in right here. Just because they feel that they didn't get a fair shake in court doesn't mean that there's a need for post-conviction investigations. There are certain criteria and guidelines that you need to hit to make sure that you're able to do them, right?
So my understanding, at least in Massachusetts, it's not a particularly difficult process if a convicted party wants to have their case screened. What happens is they'll make that sort of application, and the appellate attorney will get the whole thing. They'll get the trial transcripts, they'll get the full discovery packages, all the police reports, grand jury testimony, evidence, so on and so forth. And they'll run through it, soup to nuts, beginning to end, just to make sure that everything was done up to par. And that might include judges' decisions. It might include strategic decisions that defense counsel made that may or may not have been great. Improper jury activity or selection processes. There's a lot of different things, more so than just whether or not he still says he's innocent. You know what I mean? And so the difference between criminal defense versus this post-conviction process is it feels like it's just a hair off. But in reality, because the burden of proof is now on the convicted party who used to be the defendant, the investigation's now been turned on its head. So even though you are still investigating guilt and innocence to some extent, you're now in the driver's seat. You know, you almost have to take on the role that the police took on during the trial process. And you are now more or less indicting the trial process. That screening that the appellate attorney goes through is going to come up with a list of things. And those lists of things are, I would guess, comparable to an indictment that an attorney that a police officer might come up with and then refer to the DA. Right. And so then the investigator's duty there is to parse out. There's going to be legal arguments, and the appellate attorney will do their own research into those legal arguments just to make sure that those decisions were made right. But there could be things that were not explored appropriately, and that an investigator can help that appellate attorney parse out so that they can make a motion for a new trial or whatever it's called in your state, much stronger.
Sure. Yeah. And that's the thing to understand there, that there has to be that you can make the application to have an appellate attorney review your file, right? That's an easy process in Massachusetts. I'm not familiar with New York, but I'm sure it's probably similar. Just because you make that application, though, doesn't mean that you're going to meet the criteria. So the attorney has to feel that there was some sort of impropriety, whether it be jury or investigation or procedural, legal procedure, to hit those guidelines. And one of the things that has really fueled the investigative side of it is something called the Innocence Project. And you referenced in your article, 3,200 convictions overturned, and then 18% of them were the result of DNA. So only 18%. That means that there's a lot of legwork, other reasons why those convictions would be overturned. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think those DNA exonerations get a lot of press because it's one of those kind of it's a sharp turn. You know, it's the thing that you can point to, almost like the defense version of a smoking gun. The DNA shows he was not guilty, and so that's why they let him out.
If the glove don't fit, you can't acquit. You must acquit, right?
But you know, not every case, as you said in the 18% there is 100 minus 18. That means that there's more than 80% of cases that didn't have the DNA to rely on, and so those are the cases where. An investigator can make a lot of their work done. Certainly a lot of those 80% plus are the appellate attorneys that are going to take it and make legal arguments that the investigator is necessarily involved in. I would say I am personally, let me break it down. We've got essentially legal error, juror issues, and that ineffective assistance of counsel. Those are the main reasons why a case may go for a successful appeal. Right. And those second two are the ones where investigators will make their money. More so the third than the second. So when I say that, I mean the ineffective assistance of counsel. That's when you look at the decisions that the defense trial counsel made throughout the trial process. Maybe they never had an investigator in the first place. Maybe the investigation was done by a paralegal or by themselves, and they didn't think to ask this question or find this witness, or maybe they took too long to subpoena this person, so they never showed up to trial, or this or that. You know, there's a lot of decisions that are going to be Monday morning quarterbacked, you know, and so even good attorneys, good, well-meaning, well-intentioned attorneys will have their decisions looked at. So it's not necessarily ineffective assistance from a perspective of they were a bad attorney, they did a bad job. It's really just kind of taking a look at whether or not their strategic decision made sense, or if, you know, their decision really was a big red mark on the case, whether they meant it to be that way or not. Ultimately, what we need to do is get over the hump where we can then make the argument to the appellate judge that but for that error having taken place, there's a reasonable probability that there would have been a different outcome.
Right.
That's really what it is. I'm not sure. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but to my knowledge, that's not as well defined as I think it would be nice. I mean, we've got a pretty good definition of all of the other standards of proof, like beyond a reasonable doubt and things like that. There's a little bit more of a concreteness to those definitions. But this one, I think there's still a lot of leeway in how a judge can interpret what that means. Sure. So, you know, the best thing to do is have an investigator help out so you can really start parsing out that stuff.
Yeah. So let's talk about like budgets and payments. Like, how do you get paid for doing this type of investigative work? Who's setting the budget and who's cutting the checks for that?
Well, you know, as with any other case, it could come from any number of sources. Primarily, if you're sitting in jail, you've been convicted of something, you're not going to have a lot of money yourself in your own pocket. So you have to rely on state money. And so every state is a little bit different. In Massachusetts, we've been lucky that we've got some taxpayer funded programs. We've got a new pilot program actually that just started the last couple of years that will contract with investigators to help with the attorney getting over the first hump after the screening process. There will be the point to where an investigation will take place to get them to the motion for a new trial, you know, not necessarily before they're actually filing anything in court. They might need to have some investigation done there. So Massachusetts is potentially unique there. But there's also the Innocence Project, the Innocence Program in Massachusetts. They work hand in hand. They're actually different, project and program. But those are mostly grant funded. Through different government grants and also just private donations and things like that. But then also just a lot of times the convicted party's family just really believes them still. They really want to get behind them. And so I get calls right from the jailhouse sometimes saying, call my mom, this is her number. She wants to give you some money because I really need you to get going on this or this. Talk to my appellate attorney. There's this issue that I really need to parse out.
Yeah, I mean, it would make sense that you would probably want to do that investigative work through an attorney. So you have on that. I would caution from having, Vinny's mom hire you directly, and pay you in meatballs. I would take in meatballs. It's like cash. So, it's got to be through an attorney.
The thing about appellate cases is they're so fact specific. Right. Because again, you're no longer breaking down a case like in the trial process where, you find the loose link and you kind of poke at it until the state's case falls apart. It's your job to now make the case. And in order to make the case, you have to identify those appellate issues. Right. And the attorney is the one that identifies those appellate issues. You need to definitely have a good communication and understanding of what those appellate issues are.
So that's a good point. Let's talk about the ear method that you wrote about, and then we'll talk about the RIP method after that.
Sure. So ear, this was just kind of my own way of easily describing the method that you might want to go through when you're developing the priorities and what it is that you're going to do with your case, specifically in the criminal defense trial phase. In order to do post-conviction, you need to understand what the trial looks like in order to do the investigation of what the trial should have looked like, if that makes sense. So EAR is E-A-R, E being you need to establish and understand what the state's theory is, because again, it's their burden of proof in the criminal defense case. Mm-hmm. Then you need to attack that, and then you're going to remodel it based on the information that you discover in your own investigation. Now, that's a little bit different from the post-conviction investigations that you might want to go through, because now burden of proof is on you. So I had written about and offered the RIP method as being a little bit more appropriate for post-conviction investigations. And that would be, first, you need to recognize each one of those appellate issues. Each one of those appellate issues is going to be a circumstance, specifically an argument about why the defendant was not given a fair trial during the trial process. And it could be anything from the arrest or prior to the arrest all the way up to the conviction and what happened at the conviction.
Right.
So that'd be R, recognize. I would be isolate each one of those instances, because each individual instance is going to be deserving of its own little mini investigation. Certainly each one could bleed into the other, but you need to isolate them so that you truly understand them and you're giving them their due diligence. And then RIP, R-I-P, P would be when you're prioritizing, because if anybody's ever spent some time with a convicted party, there's nobody with more motivation to find something wrong with their case than somebody who's been convicted and they don't believe that they should have been convicted. So yeah, they're going to have
the most to lose. Sure.
I'm sorry?
They have the most to lose, obviously.
Well, of course. They're the ones that are sitting there. They've got all the time in the world and they've got this file in front of them that they can perseverate on. And sometimes they're the best source of information on their own case, because they're going to know their case better than I or the attorney's ever going to know the case.
Sure.
But that also means they're going to have a laundry list of stuff, and a good chunk of that stuff is not going to be worthwhile pursuing because they're not attorneys. They don't understand what the appellate issues need to be. They might focus on something that's kind of not going to move the needle in the eyes of the judge. And so that's why you need to have that serious conversation with the attorney so that you're prioritizing what each one of those isolated mini investigations is going to be, not only just to make sure you're doing the budget the right thing, but to make sure that you're spending your time the most wise way possible for the benefit of the case.
Absolutely. So I got to think that there are times, and I don't know how frequently this happens, that you start looking into something, right? You have a theory of like, okay, we think this may have occurred, this misconduct, but we're not 100% sure. Like, I got to believe that there are times that you go through and you do the research and you're like, nope, they got it right. Like, sorry, buddy. You know, like you have this idea about something, but it's not the case, right? Do you see that happen frequently or?
Guilt or innocence is, I don't want to say irrelevant because that's not accurate, but it's secondary, I think, because I'm not necessarily looking to see, you know, whether they did this or that. What I'm looking to see is what evidence has been proven or has been presented, I should say, and whether or not that evidence is accurate and whether that evidence was gathered and then presented in a just and constitutional way. So it would be inappropriate for me to say that innocence doesn't matter or guilt doesn't matter. But right. when you're really taking it from an investigation point of view, you really want to break it down into each one of those individual isolated instances of unjust evidence. And so, for example, you know, you might find that there's a whole new witness. So this whole new witness puts all the rest of the evidence in a new light. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the other evidence is wrong. It's just that there is now new evidence. And this new evidence could have and should have been discovered during the trial process, but was not. And but for that error, there would have been a different outcome.
Sure.
Right. So if I know that a guy, one of my cases, for example, if I know that a guy is alleged to have been the shooter inside a tiny burger joint in the middle of Dorchester, and they have a witness presented at trial saying, yeah, that's the shooter. But then they've got another witness that I've now discovered that the police didn't bother to go look for that says, no, he was standing outside on the sidewalk with me. I was standing 5 feet away from him. I know he's not the shooter.
Right.
Why didn't the police go find that one? Maybe this witness that I found is going to be more compelling to the jury than the witness that the police found, because maybe they're a more believable person. Do you know what I mean? And so it's about finding evidence and testing the evidence, testing the justness of the evidence, more so than I'm not the judge. I'm not the guy that decides guilt or innocence.
Right.
Knowing your role and staying within your lane.
You know, and every now and then you get these accusations or hearing of like intentional misconduct and things like that. Like that's got to be like a mind blower. Like when you start going down the rabbit hole in which you're uncovering, going, wow, this person like knowingly suppressed evidence that would have exonerated somebody. Like, how do you sleep at night?
anybody that's coming to my Boston conference and is going to come to that dinner presentation is going to hear from the exonerees. And one of them, I'll let him do the explaining of his case. But that one, his case is just flatly a misconduct case.
Yeah.
He was literally framed for the case that he was convicted for. And you hate reading stuff like that because, you know, what the heck, you know, it's, yeah. I don't want to put myself into the mind of the police when they do things like that, but you have to wonder what they could have possibly been.
Yeah. And unfortunately it probably happens more than we realize too, which is absolutely crazy. I mean, you get to this point where somebody wants a promotion, somebody wants to, you know, take that next step in their career and, you know, this guy's a criminal anyway. Okay, he didn't do this, but he probably did something else. You know, that's how I'm justifying it. But, you know, our justice system doesn't work that way, you know,
unfortunately. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I don't want to make it seem as though police misconduct is, you know, the reason for all of the injustice in the world. You know,
I think
a lot of police that are out there, they're doing their best. They're trying to 100%. Do their job. Maybe there's a training issue. Maybe they thought that they did enough, but in reality, they didn't quite get over the hump. And so the post-conviction effort just tries to identify whether or not they were fairly convicted or not. You know, again, it's also worth mentioning, sorry to interrupt you there, but
yeah, go ahead.
We're not in the post-conviction world trying to prove innocence. we're trying to prove their trial was unjust and therefore deserves a new trial. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So we're not trying to say this person should be exonerated, let's let him go home. If the judge, the appellate judge, were to grant a new trial, they're going to throw away the conviction, but then it's back in the ball is back in the state's court. They could just retry it. You know what
double
I mean?
Jeopardy, baby. Bring on the double jeopardy. Yeah.
But and then it's a whole new ball game where a whole new trial, and then you're basically right back to square one, and then you do the whole process again. Or maybe the state decides, you know, it's not worth it because they've already served a certain amount of time and that's enough, or the evidence is not going to be as good to try with anymore. But it makes a difference from a post conviction perspective. I don't need to be anything other than the guy who's going out and trying to gather information. It's not on me to try him. It's not on me to judge him or her. It's up to me to work with the client to make sure I'm identifying those potential issues for appellate reasons and then attack them with the investigation. But everything else is very similar. You're still doing interviews. You're still doing case analysis. You're still going out to the crime scene and doing all the measurements and analysis and photography. And it's just the whole thing rests in how do you plan your case at the beginning.
Yeah, it's fascinating. The whole appellate world is it's so different. You know, and there are no guarantees. I've seen on the civil side, you know, verdicts get appealed and you're like, yeah, it's a no brainer. Like, this is nonsense that they came up with this. And they'll go and the attorney will spend, you know, $15,000, $25,000, $30,000, $50,000 to have an appeal done. And they still lose anyway. So, you know, like, I've seen that happen a few times. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like on a civilly, you know, yes, this was, there's an issue here, but you know, that monetary award is not consistent with what it should be. You know, it should be, you know, we're going to reduce it to this. Like, I've seen that happen too. I saw an $81 million verdict get reduced to $375,000, you know, and what's crazy is after the $81 million verdict, in the defendants came back, instead of going to file an appeal, they offered $9 million. And this was for like a group of individuals. It wasn't just one person.
Yeah.
It's a civil rights issue, right? The biggest injury was a broken nose, but there were valid civil rights things that were done, right? So the party decided, no, we're not going to take that $9 million. You know, we're going to, you know, you want to appeal it, go ahead and appeal it. But we got our 81, right? And the judge set aside. Like, I was in the courtroom when this happened. So the verdict came down. $81 million. And the judge was like, no, I don't think you understood my instructions, my charge to jury. Like, you guys need to go back. And he sent them back in for like 2 hours to go deliberate some more. And they came back out, $81 million. And it's like, the judge is like, it's Bronx County, New York. The judge is like, I'm setting aside this verdict. And he looks at all the plaintiffs. He goes, you're never going to see this money. Right? That's right from the bench. Right? Like, this is crazy. Right? So fast forward. The defendants offer $9 million. The plaintiffs say, no, we're not taking it. And it gets reduced and they get $375,000 and good luck in your future endeavors. So, yeah, it crazy. I mean,
$375,000, that might not even be enough to cover expenses.
Probably not. I'm sure with the amount of money they spent on the appeal and like the appeal wasn't on their side. The appeal was on, you know, the defense had appealed it, but you still need to now pay for your attorney to handle all that stuff because that's not part of the initial, you know, one third that they pay for the case to be handled.
And paying for the attorney, you're paying for all the doctors and experts and transcriptions and all of the files that you're asking for. It's expensive.
So yeah, the point I'm making on that is sometimes it's not like, ooh, the bad policeman, because, you know, we're very pro police here. Let's be clear about it. Yeah. Sometimes it's a procedural thing. Sometimes it's an interpretation of law. And that's what makes this country great, right? That we have the ability to interpret laws and work on them. But sometimes it's not everybody's going to see things the same way. And if you don't have enough evidence to sway that opinion, kind of it is what it is, right?
Well, I think it's a little bit more of a philosophical point, but you know, truth isn't really a thing. in my opinion. Truth is this thing. It's like a figment of everybody's imagination. I'm trying to find this information. The other side's trying to find this information. But at the end of the day, I wasn't there. And what the two people that were involved in an incident might themselves have their own truths of what happened. And so it's a subjective thing. Every investigation's a gray area. And so that's why we have this adversarial system,
Sure.
so that we can kind of go at each other in an organized fashion and do it the best we can to be as fair as we can.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, truth is, it really, I mean, it's what everyone agrees to, right? That's what a truth really is. We want to start getting super, super deep with this. I feel like we're going into Joe Rogan territory. We're going to leave that alone. But it's so interesting. You just got to really appreciate that our legal system allows post-conviction investigations to even happen. Because I think there's many societies and cultures where that's it, man. Siberia. See you later. And get to work.
I think I read once that Japan, they do like the death penalty. I'm pretty sure it's Japan, but don't quote me on that. They'll just convict you, like, boom, and not convict you, but they will death penalty, boom, like that. You don't have a chance for.
No, once you're dead, you're dead. You can't. Oops.
We don't have any wrongful convictions. They're all dead.
It reminds me of the Naked Gun, right? For Frank Drebin. Oh, here's the missing evidence. It turns out he didn't do it. Frank, we executed that guy like 3 years ago. Oops.
Well,
There we go.
yeah.
All
No,
right.
I'm glad to see that there's more attention and more money being funneled into these post-conviction and investigations. There's a lot of people that are seeing that there's a chance. You know what I mean? And it's unfortunate because I believe that wrongful convictions happen a lot more than we as a society really want to believe. It doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't do what they were accused of doing in a general sense, but the statute, you know what I mean? How were they overcharged and then convicted of something that they really didn't do? Maybe they were up to no good, but they're convicted of murder, but they weren't there to kill anybody. Maybe they were there to sell drugs or something like that, but then they get a sentence for 50 years because they're convicted of murder. That doesn't make sense. So I'm parsing out, and I'm splitting hairs a little bit, and I'm just kind of making up stuff on the fly with that one. But that's the point of the gray area. That's why we do the job.
It's all good. All right, so we're gonna wrap it up here. So the NALI conference is taking place up in Boston. There'll be a very cool dinner on the 4th of April, and there will be a full day chock full of great material on the 5th.
Yeah.
Just a great event to be a part of, and come check it out. If you're in the Northeast, I strongly suggest make the effort to go out there and check it out. It's we'll have a link in on the website on how to
Yeah. There's actually a few rooms left in the block at the Colonnade Hotel. You can give a call over to the Colonnade and mention that you're going to be attending the NALI conference. And there's a few rooms left. I think we have one more week left. So I think it's what's today, the 15th. So I think it's the 22nd is when the block expires. So if
With
you want
Wall,
to get
man, you're killing my show here, the mystique of my show. So we're recording this on March 15th. By the time you folks are hearing it, it's going to be the 18th. So
Oh, well, I apologize for ruining the
that's it. You've ruined everything.
mystique.
I'm
But yeah,
done with
you have up
podcasting.
until the 22nd to book with the Colonnade Hotel, and you'll be able to get in on the discounted rate. And then the conference is at the Northeastern University Egan Research Center, which is just down the street from the Colonnade.
Awesome. Awesome. Dan, so
April
much
4th.
thank you so much for coming on and sharing, and thank you for your passion and your vision to put together things like this, because I've done it before and I know how exhausting it is. And we're all business owners, we all investigators, and we wear many hats, and to put together a quality event like you've put together, I mean, kudos to you. Really, really good job.
I appreciate it. It wouldn't be right for me to accept all that praise and not give a shout out to Val and her team with Nally.
Thank you.
She does so much that I wouldn't be able to plan stuff like this without.
Yeah, no, the people behind the scenes make everybody look good.
That's right.
And geez, you got to deal with George Gurgis too, which is terrible. If I don't take a shot at
George.
George and we're talking about Nally, then I haven't done my job.
George is I think he's actually going to be attending as well. So you'll have some big names showing up in Boston in a few weeks.
Fantastic. I thought he was banned from the state. I guess they're lifting that ban.
No, he's very welcome.
Yeah. Now we know who stole those paintings from the Isabella Gardner Museum. George, don't do it. Anyways, I digress here. So thank you so much again, Dan, for coming on. And thanks to everyone for tuning into the show. And we'll have a new show for you actually next week. So tune in. Take care. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for checking out the show. Please make sure you follow PI Perspectives on YouTube now. We appreciate Dan coming on the podcast and how he shares his take on post-conviction investigations. We want to thank Campbell Insurance Group for sponsoring our show, and remember to tell them you listen to save $50 when you apply for insurance. There's additional thanks for Scope Now, Pacific Liability Research, and the PI Institute for Education. Also, don't forget about investigatorstoolbox.com. You can type in perspectives 50 to save 50 bucks when you join. Please also follow Matt at Satellite Investigations on LinkedIn. If you have a question or a comment about the show, email Matt at matthews@satellitepi.com. You can also find him on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Facebook. We'd like your feedback to bring you the best shows possible, and we'll be back next week with a brand new show. So make sure you tune in and stay safe out there.